night, good friends, and welcome back. Sunday night, 8 until 10 p.m. Central Time here on We the People Radio Network. That means it's time for INN War Report Radio. I'm your host, Tom Kiley. And every Sunday we come to you here on We the People. And we used to call this the INN Weekend Report. Maybe we're going to have to go back to that. We used to be on Sunday evenings, and then for a time we were on Wednesdays and Fridays as well. But we're back on Sunday, so we could call this the Weekend Report. But in any case, this is INN War Report Radio, and we say that because of our television program, INN World Report, on Free Speech TV. And that is a channel that is a national channel on the Dish Network satellite system. So if you've got Dish, I encourage you to check the program out. It's on Dish Network's channel 9415. And that is their Free Speech TV channel. You can think of it as a sort of a national public access channel. And it's an alternative media channel, much the same as We the People Radio Network is an alternative media radio station. And we like to say that we bring you the news the networks won't tell you. And because of our offerings there, we got together with our good friends here at We the People, and we have a radio talk show version of the program now as well. We've been on the air a little over a year now, about 13 months. And we really like this because it gives us the opportunity to speak with INN War Report television viewers, to speak with people here at We the People Radio Network who may not have seen INN War Report yet. We encourage you to take a look at it. Our website is now back up on the web and refurbished. It's quite nice now, and you can go there and watch our program as well. If you don't have Dish Network, you don't have to view the program on your satellite TV. You can also watch it on the web. And that would be on innworldreport.net. So please check that out if you haven't seen the program on Dish Network. And you can also find many, many of our reports now on YouTube. So if you are a user of YouTube, then you can search YouTube for INN or INN World Report, and you can see many of our reports there. If, good friends, you are not a user of YouTube, I suggest that you go there because there are so many interesting videos now that are available. They run the gamut. They're professionally produced or produced by amateurs. A lot of it's junk, of course, a lot of it's silly stuff, but you can find a great deal of information there being presented on such matters, for instance, as 9/11 Truth, and, a lot of information that either the corporate media is not talking about or, for instance, you can see clips of documentaries. I encourage you to take a look at Google's video as well. Go to Google Video, and there people have posted entire reports, for instance, by the BBC. The BBC, which, in some cases, does a pretty good job of uncovering things, at least that the American media doesn't talk about. And then in some other cases lately is doing a rather poor job. And we're going to talk about that with our first guest who will be coming up in about 10 minutes or so. We're going to have Richard Gage, AIA, Richard Gage, architect and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And we'll be speaking with him about the latest at his organization. They are now up over 400 architects and engineers that have signed up to be part of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. If you ask me, I think the actual number is probably going to end up being more than that, maybe 500 by now. But it's their process of clearing and verifying that the people who are in fact signing up are architects or engineers takes a while. So, but they've got far more applicants that they haven't cleared. I shouldn't say far more. They've got a lot more that they haven't cleared. But Richard could tell us about that. We can also speak with Richard about what people have characterized, and most notably Alex Jones, have characterized as a hit piece that was done by the BBC about Building 7. That's something that came out back, I think, in the first week of July. I was aware of it. I was not in the country at the time, but the first thing I did when I got back is I looked it up. I believe I might have saw it on Google Video or through Alex Jones' website, perhaps. But it was an hour-long piece, and they sought, it looked to me like they sought to poo-poo or make a hit piece out of the skeptics on the official story about how Building 7 collapsed. The official story, by the way, which is kind of a difficult thing to even ascertain in and of itself, because the official story isn't really complete yet, is it? There still is not the final report, all these years later, soon to be 7 years later. There still isn't the final report by the government as to what happened, so they're still trying to get their story straight. They're still trying to concoct some sort of reasoning or logic that can explain how this building fell down without being hit by an aircraft. And, the BBC is actually involved in a very strange way, if you're not familiar with what happened at Building 7. Building 7, by the way, I am assuming, and maybe this is not a correct thing to do, but I'm assuming, good friends, that you are aware that Building 7 is the third building that collapsed on September 11th, 2001, in New York. You'd be surprised when you ask people about it how many people do not, in fact, realize that three buildings collapsed that day. Building 7, of course, came down at about 5:20 in the afternoon, seemingly all by itself. Certainly it wasn't struck by any aircraft. And I make that assumption. I'm assuming that most of you are very hip people because you are informing yourselves, you are listening to the alternative media, and you're not watching, America's next pop singing idol or something or whatever, or some kind of reality show. So I'm assuming that most of you out there know about Building 7, but that's not a fair assumption. There may be some who don't. In any case, Building 7 came down on its own steam, as it were, by some magical force about 5:20 in the afternoon that day. The other two buildings, of course, the towers, came down earlier, much earlier that morning. And interestingly, if you don't know, and I'm assuming, again, most of you may know this, but if you don't, I'm going to tell you right now, and you can actually see this video footage of which I'm about to speak on YouTube. But the BBC was reporting with a straight face that Building 7 collapsed live that day at the top of their 5 o'clock segment on their one of their programs, one of their international programs. And there was a reporter, I think her name is Jane Seymour or something like that, just Jane Stanley, I think. And she's standing in front of a camera, and over her shoulder is the Lower Manhattan skyline, and you can actually see over her shoulder Building 7 standing, and she's telling everyone that they're getting a report now that it has collapsed. That happened 15 minutes before the building actually came down. And of course, it's a mystery as to how anybody knew that building was going to come down ahead of time, and how the BBC knew. And that is, I say it's a mystery because the BBC goes into convulsions trying to explain that it was a misinformation, they weren't sure, there were other reports, they don't know who told them. And then when pressed for their own tapes on the subject, the BBC claimed for years that they couldn't be found, that they were lost, the tapes. And additionally, Jane Stanley's broadcast came off the air about 5 minutes before the building actually did come down. They said, oops, looks like we've lost contact with Jane Stanley in New York. And it's a good thing, too, because the building would have fallen down behind her, the building that she'd just gotten done telling everyone about 20 minutes earlier that had already come down. It would have been pretty embarrassing, but fortunately for the BBC, the embarrassment was spared them because the transmission was interrupted somehow. So I guess the BBC's gotten a lot of heat for that. Certainly a lot of the British public have teed off on the BBC's blog about this. So I guess the BBC felt compelled to make them look somewhat less foolish about it. Their term in British parlance was that it was a cock-up. I believe that means it was some kind of a screw-up as to how they lost the tapes and how this thing, how they got word. They don't know who told them. It was, common knowledge. Other people were reporting it, supposedly. And, boy, you should read the blog on the BBC's website about this. The British people who pay for the BBC through the taxes, by the way. I believe there's a special television tax they have over there that if you own a TV, there's a tax that you pay, and it goes into this kind of programming on the BBC. But, you know, they're extremely skeptical as to how they could have lost this thing. And then they were also teeing off, as I recall when I read it, about what's this? The BBC is now reporting rumors. There were rumors that the building fell down. You know, the BBC vaunted for its supposed accuracy in reporting, now doesn't know where their source was, doesn't remember, and it was a rumor that was going around, somewhat, so on and so forth. Well, they seek to deal with a lot of these issues in their hit piece on the Building 7 collapse, which, like I said, I believe was July 6th that came out, something to that effect. And I watched it myself, and they explain all kinds of things. They seem to now have found the tapes. They were on the wrong shelf. They were on the shelf for September 2002, not 2001. It was just a simple misunderstanding. The interruption in Jane Stanley's transmission was because the timer was set to cancel the transmission at 5:15. Nothing mysterious or anything like that, and so on. And I took a look at it myself. I found it very interesting to watch all the squirming around that they did. And then, you know, I'm particularly interested in the scientific evidence from people like Professor Stephen Jones from Brigham Young University and his evidence of thermite having been used. And they try to deal with that. Very interestingly, I'll go into just one bit that I was waiting for and watching for, and that is how someone had given Professor Jones a sample of the dust. There was a lot of dust that day, and it made its way all over the lower tip of Manhattan, and actually made its way to Brooklyn, where I live, across the river. There was dust on the cars when I got home that day. Not nearly as thick, of course, but it was very thick in Manhattan, and somebody had taken a sample of this dust off of the Brooklyn Bridge and gave it to Professor Jones to analyze. And he found a lot of interesting things in the dust. And one of the things that he found were tiny iron spheres and silicon spheres. And this, he deduces, is evidence of thermite, because thermite produces iron. And when you hurl molten metal through the air, is, you know, particularly small particles of molten metal, they form spheres, they form balls. That's how we used to make shot in this country. There was, or around the world, I should say, there was this famous structures called shot towers, where they would melt lead at the top, and then they would drop them through the tower, and they would hit a pool of water at the bottom. And you know, the ones that were good and round were used for shot. So he found, you know, many, many of these microspheres in the dust. What's the BBC's explanation for this? Get a load of this. Are you sitting down, friends? Because this is great. I call this the BBC flying balls theory. Okay, I think there ought to be a name for it. The BBC, in a very straight official voice, you know, is talking. There's a woman, actually. I can't do a woman British voice, but I'll, you know, well, you know, perhaps the spheres came from the welders who were cutting the steel that day to, you know, or, you know, in the rescue effort. Very interesting. Welders cutting the steel with torches perhaps caused the iron balls to form and fly around. Well, that's a load of bull, friends, because depending on which end of the Brooklyn Bridge you're looking at, okay, the near end of the Brooklyn Bridge to Ground Zero is almost a half a mile away, all right? So, and the far end is almost a mile and a half away. So somehow the welders' torches were capable of creating these little iron balls, which then flew through the air somehow over to the Brooklyn Bridge, at least a half a mile away, depending on where he took the sample from. Not only that, good friends, but these magic BBC balls apparently are capable of time travel as well, because the dust was instant after the collapse of the towers. Okay, that was out there right away, and it was out there from the morning on. All right, the welders, to my knowledge, at best probably didn't get there for at least many hours or several hours after that. So the balls, the little tiny balls that the BBC talks about, the magic flying balls of the BBC, Not only were they capable of hurling themselves through the air from a welder's torch at least a half a mile away, but they were capable of doing it hours before the welder showed up. So anyhow, that's something we can talk about. And we will be speaking shortly with, Richard Gage is going to be joining us shortly, AIA, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So in any case, are we on break yet? Because my screen is not refreshing, and it looks like, let's see here. Time is 9:50. Not yet, okay. Very good, good friends. I'm sorry, we're having a bit of technical difficulty here. My clock for the show is off a bit here, so just have to bear with me. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that presentation. That's the BBC Magic Flying Balls Theory. That was in their presentation on Building 7. Maybe we can ask Richard Gage about that when he joins us in just a few moments. In any case, then the second hour, that's going to be us, good friends. The second hour, it'll be open phones. We'll talk about whatever it is that's on your mind. Open phones, no particular topic. So I'm going to ask you to just hang on there. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes with Richard Gage, AIA, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. We'll be right back.
Online and on demand, this is We the People Radio Network.
All right, good friends, welcome back. This is Tom Kiley on INN War Report Radio. And as promised, tonight our first guest is one of my favorite people in the 9/11 Truth Movement, good friends, I must tell you. He's done just an outstanding job. A committed American, is it fair to say, Richard, a staunch Republican from the San Francisco Bay Area. And
less
architect.
And less staunch. Less and less staunch each day.
Well, a staunch American in any case. Richard Gage, AIA, architect and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Richard, welcome back to INN War Report Radio, and it's always a pleasure to have you. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Richard, I'd like you to tell us what's new, because I know that your organization itself is constantly evolving. Your body of information about what happened on September the 11th is constantly evolving. And importantly, the number of your members is also constantly evolving. Can you lead that one off by telling us first, how many architects and engineers do you have now that are signed up in your organization?
Well, we have over 400 now demanding a real investigation of Congress of the three high-rise collapses on 9/11. Many people don't know there were three high-rises brought down on 9/11. So I always start with Building 7. So we'll get to the evidence around that. But some people also don't know who I am. I've been an architect for 20 years, and I've worked on many different steel-framed fireproof structures. And I was 2 years ago, I became interested in the collapses of these high-rises when I heard David Ray Griffin on the radio, and it shocked me, literally. I had to pull my car over hearing him being interviewed on Bonnie Faulkner's Guns and Butter show. I couldn't believe what I was hearing from this gentleman. It was the first time I had ever heard any evidence or suggestion that the Twin Towers might have been brought down by any force other than the airplanes and the jet fuel fires.
So you had quite clearly a very powerful epiphany there. You were driving down the road. Good thing you pulled over. And good thing you were listening to that program, Richard, because I must tell you, as a result, you know, perhaps you would have heard about this sooner or later anyway, but as a result of you having heard that and the way you must have heard it, it really pressed you into action, and I think you've done just an outstanding job and your vision on how to approach this from a technical angle. What happened after you heard the program? What kind course of action did you go on?
I checked out what Dr. Griffin was saying. He was quoting, for instance, the 118 firefighters who heard explosions at the onset of these collapses or saw flashes of light. And Dr. Griffin talked about the beams being ejected laterally out of these buildings at 50 miles an hour and landing 600 feet away, the ends of these beams, many of them dripping with molten metal, as seen by the first responders and iron workers. The 90,000 tons of concrete that was pulverized to powder, not found down at the bottom of either Twin Tower, I mean 110 floors, missing. All you see is a pile of scrap metal. It's a big problem for the official story, which tells us this was a gravitational collapse, which should have trapped bodies in between these floors, and yet ejected extremely tiny pieces of bodies like bone fragments a half an inch long, such that 700 of them were found on top of the Deutsche Bank building across the street, for instance. There's these huge problems of like molten metal found underneath the Twin Towers. So what did I do? I went to the presentation that night, and unfortunately they were sold out, so I listened on the simulcast at home, and I looked around and tried to find other architects and engineers that had been grouping together to stand up and call for a real investigation, and there weren't any. I couldn't believe it. I mean, here am I, just, you know, an average architect looking around for somebody else to be talking, and lo and behold, there weren't any. So we started Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and we've been collecting the evidence and putting it on our website, ae911truth.org. That's www.ae911truth.org. And there's much assembled there, including a DVD that people can purchase and or watch online. And there's the PowerPoint that's current that we give in a different city every other week throughout the country. And much evidence listed that people can find. And we've now attracted over 400 architects, and it's really pretty much every architect or an engineer that we show this presentation to agrees with us that there are extremely serious problems with the official story, and they signed the petition.
And these are people who may be skeptical or actually believers in the official story before your presentation begins, correct? In some cases.
Sure, just about every one of them. Everybody starts out, not everybody. Some people knew these were explosions right off the bat. And in fact, many of us should have, but let's face it, we were all put in a state of shock that morning, and we didn't know what we were looking at. None of us had ever seen a high-rise destroyed before, either by controlled demolition or any other means. That is to say, by this manner of controlled demolition. In the case of the Twin Towers, this is an extremely explosive event where everything almost is blown outside the footprint of these buildings, and this mushrooming volcanic almost eruption with pyroclastic-like clouds with the incredible heat produced by these special types of explosives, incendiaries in this case, for which there's chemical evidence of thermite in the beams, in the dust, in the molten metal chunks found underneath all three.
Little tiny iron balls, right, in the dust, and the BBC has a very interesting explanation. I'm talking about when you're saying the evidence of thermite being used, the tiny iron spheres, microspheres in the dust is evidence of thermite,
yes,
as well, I believe, right?
Dr. Jones finds in all of the dust samples that he's got, and there's at least four of them at this time found across the street on the top of a high-rise, that is in the middle of the high-rise in an apartment that filled that apartment, a foot full of dust, on top of a high-rise two blocks away, and on top of the Brooklyn Bridge, somebody collected dust over there as well. And all of these samples have iron-rich microspheres, most of them smaller than a human hair, indicating extremely high-pressure event involving liquid molten iron. Well, fires, jet fuel fires included, do not produce liquid molten iron. These are temperatures far exceeding 4,000 degrees. So what could produce that? Well, it turns out that if there were thousands of cutter charges throughout the columns and beams in these towers, and this particular cutter charge is proven to have been nanothermite now, which is more explosive. Under these pressures, the molten iron would turn itself into these tiny iron-rich microspheres. The byproduct of thermite is molten iron.
And as it's hurled through the air, gravity naturally takes a liquid and makes a ball out of it, like a raindrop.
Yeah, well, the surface tension of the molten iron forms itself into almost a sphere like a raindrop. So it's very, very telling, and it has the chemical evidence of thermite in the potassium, the manganese, the aluminum, and the iron, and in many cases, the sulfur as well.
Richard, I'm going to ask you to hold on because we're going on break. And by the way, the BBC has a very interesting theory about that. I call it the BBC's flying balls theory, but maybe we can talk about that a little later. We're talking good friends with Richard Gage, AIA architect and former founder, I should say, of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. We'll be right back.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Lighting the fires of liberty with your host, Michael Badnarik, from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Central, Monday through Friday, only on We the People Radio Network.
Good friends, just like the good song says there, that's the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, by the way. If you want to get to heaven, you got to raise a little H-E-double-L, and that's what we like to do right here on INN World Report Radio, and that's what we're going to be doing tonight. We're speaking with Richard Gage, architect AIA from the San Francisco Bay Area and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I'm proud to have Richard on our program. This is about the third time, I think, now that Richard's been here on INN World Report Radio. It's always a pleasure. And I asked Richard to come on and let us know what's the latest, as well as the excellent summary that he is giving, which, by the way, is part of his presentation. I encourage you to see it if you haven't. In fact, I encourage you to purchase perhaps a copy of his DVD. You'll get the whole thing, and you can bring it around, show your friends and family, and it'll be a little bit of a contribution as well to Architects and Engineers. But they don't have to do that, do they, Richard? People can also watch your presentation if they don't catch you at one of your many live demonstrations of it. They can also watch it on your website, correct?
Yeah. Just click on the DVD on the left side. Also, people can step through the PowerPoint at their own the slideshow at their own pace on the left side as well, and that is even more updated information. In fact, it includes the discussion and illustrations of the red chips that Dr. Jones found in each of the dust samples. These red chips respond to magnets, and guess what they turn out to be? Small chips of nanothermite unexploded pieces. One of them is a 16th of an inch long, and it's red on one side and gray on the other. The red side is composed of extremely small particles of iron oxide, almost homogeneously mixed with the aluminum, equally small aluminum particles. And guess what? The problem is that these are not made in a cave in Afghanistan. This is very, very high-tech stuff that only recently has been published in the last few years in Lawrence Livermore Lab. So this was the advanced state-of-the-art incendiaries that become extremely explosive due to their small size and hence their large surface area. producing an almost instantaneous chemical reaction, which is why we, presumably, we get the extremely explosive event in the case of the Twin Towers.
Well, you know, also, Richard, you know, they keep saying that sometimes, you know, the simplest explanation is one that you ought to look at. And if somebody's bending through hoops to try to explain something, the source of the tremendous heat below all three of the World Trade Center buildings that came down, the two towers and Building 7, that heat, which was there well into December, as I understand it, or into December, okay, for months, that presents a problem for the official story, doesn't it? Because you can't get oxygen down there at the bottom of that pile to sustain fire and heat all that time.
Well, that's the least of the problems. The question is where the tons of molten metal came from in the first place. It was seen, for instance, by Leslie Robertson, who quotes at a structural engineering conference in October, as of 21 days after the attack, there was molten steel, he calls it, still running. And Peter Tully talks about molten metal. He's the head of the construction company. Mark Loiseau confirms that his workers saw running molten metal in trenches they were digging in the under the South Tower or near the South Tower. So the Avaris equipment picks up these extremely hot temperatures on the surface. This particular equipment from the USGS overflights, it is documenting 1300 to 1400 degree temperatures. Well, the problem is that these are temperatures associated with the hottest office fires, and there's no fires on the surface of Ground Zero after these collapses. The temperatures are the source heat is well below down in the basement where these temperatures are from the molten metal as seen by all of these first responders. They quote flowing like lava. They said they were just all awestruck. They have never seen it before in any fire. Why? Well, because fires only burn 1200 to 1400 degrees in the hottest office fires. So even jet fuel only burns that hot. It's a regular hydrocarbon. So where is the production of all this molten metal coming from? It can only be explained by what explains the rest of the evidence, the byproduct of thermite. It turns out to be, in fact, that molten iron with aluminum, potassium, manganese, and other sol gel type, there's an oxidizer called fluorine in it as well. All of this
now, Richard, this stuff, thermite doesn't need oxygen, right? Because it's got it in there already, isn't it? I mean, the chemical compound is such that it's oxidized stuff, isn't it? I mean, it's got its own source of energy and oxygen inside of it, doesn't it? Does it require open air to burn, or can once you ignite that stuff, it just goes? No.
This is why the fires continued to burn, even though the firemen said they were like basically creating a lake out there. They could not get these fires out for months.
Exactly.
Well, thermite contains its own source of oxygen.
Right. And hence, it could be hot and burning still way at the bottom of that pile without any oxygen, you know, blowing on it or coming into it. So that's a very simple explanation, isn't it, for all this hot molten metal and the continuing fires at the bottom. You've really got to jump through some hoops if you're a proponent of the official story as to how do you get these hot burning fires underneath these rubble piles for all that time, no?
In fact, there's a lot of hoops that they do have to jump through. One of them is they're claiming that the gypsum board, which contains calcium sulfate, which they say is sulfur, which is where the sulfur came from to lower the melting point of steel. But the problem is that the sulfate in calcium sulfate is chemically bound. It can't get out. It's caged. And it's never before gotten out, and it's never before produced molten molten metal or anything of the like. This is a first case scenario. It's unprecedented. It's never happened before.
And it's a triple play. It's in three different buildings on the same day, although it never happened anywhere else before. That now they're saying what wallboard was the culprit that caused these hot fires way at the bottom of this rubble pile all that time.
And wallboard is designed to be used as fireproofing to protect the steel, and it always has been, and it always has done a great job of protecting the steel. And all of a sudden, it's the cause of melting the steel for the first time in history. No, it's ludicrous. Let's talk about Building 7 since you mentioned it, because this is the third high-rise to collapse on 9/11, and many people don't even know about it because the media has not played it for us. Why not? Well, if they did play it, and finally, we do have a documentary, a one-hour documentary put out by the BBC throughout the UK, and it is showing people at least 12 times in this one-hour documentary how this they're showing this building coming down. And what you see is a precipitous global collapse of this building, which occurs in about almost 7 seconds from top to bottom. Now, this is free fall speed, just about. If you dropped a brick off the top of this building, it would fall just about as fast, just a little faster, and the brick. And the only way this can happen is if the columns are removed, the key core columns in particular, floor by floor and synchronistically timed and all at once on a given floor. Otherwise, what you have is a building that collapses, and there are plenty of controlled demolitions that go haywire due to a few misfirings of a half a second off or something. And this, though, was a almost perfect symmetrical collapse. The center of the building is sitting in the center of the pile. And this has only happened, this type of implosion, as FEMA calls it, with controlled demolition. And, of course, we have tons of molten metal found underneath this building as well.
And, you know, that gets us into some other things. Asymmetrical damage causing perfectly symmetrical collapse. I think I've got the music coming up. My clock is off tonight, good friends. Are we coming up on break there? There we go. Here we go. All right. We'll be right back. We're speaking with Richard Gage, AIA. All right, good friends. We're speaking tonight with Richard Gage, AIA, architect and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. We continue here on INN War Report Radio, right here on We the People Radio Network, every Sunday night, 8 until 10 p.m. Central Time. And let's continue, Richard. Richard, there's a sort of an ebb and flow with the truth about 9/11. You know, immediately there was a pat story that was given out about Osama bin Laden and aircraft and jet fuel and fires and steel melting and all of that. precious little of which is able to be backed up with real good science. And in any case, that science certainly wasn't available immediately when the first stories were available. There are several major factors here, and that is the official government reporting on what happened that day. But if we can just focus for a moment on Building 7, we don't even have, do we, a complete government explanation yet, almost 7 years later, about, we don't have a complete explanation as to what happened to any of the towers that day. I know that they stopped sort of short after the initiation of collapse. But we have even less information from the government about Building 7. Isn't that correct, Richard?
Yeah, the NIST report has been delayed until August now, which is 7 years too late, because FEMA came out first with their assessment. They had $600,000 to evaluate this building, and what did they find? Their conclusion is their best hypothesis, which is fire plus complete collapse, has only a low probability of occurrence. They say further research investigation is necessary in order to resolve the issue. So their best hypothesis, they have no faith in whatsoever. Now that's
isn't a low probability, isn't that a nice way of saying actually it's never happened before?
Never happened before, and they can't conceive of how it could have happened this time either. And but unfortunately for those hoping to resolve the issue, by the time the report came out in May of 2002, almost the entire site had been scrubbed. FEMA had ordered the steel recycled, and it was sent to China. In other words, this was evidence in a crime scene, which is illegal to remove. By any estimation, this was a crime. A crime scene. So what happens with the investigation then? NIST takes over, and they are still juggling the ball, and they're telling us now that their current investigation is going to come out in August, and they're saying, well, we believe our current working hypothesis is that this building came down due to fire. In fact, that fire was not even fed by diesel fuel because there were generators in the building. And they're saying it wasn't the collapse was not even partially due to the damage that the building sustained due to the World Trade Center North Tower coming down. In other words, it's normal office fires that, for the first time in history, have brought a high-rise building down, and in this case, at virtually freefall speed against 40,000 tons. Of structural steel that was designed to resist that load of that gravitational collapse for the life of the building. This is
and brought it down symmetrically as well. And then it'd be pretty hard, you know, herding cats, I think of when I try to imagine how you herd fire so that you can keep it in such a way that its symmetrical damage is being caused by it, thus causing a symmetrical collapse.
Well, NIST tells us there were 8 scattered fires throughout this building. And where the collapse starts, which is in the east end of the building under the east penthouse, approximately 10 seconds prior to the global collapse, they're telling us the fire starts there, the collapse starts there, but most of these fires were out by the time the collapse started. And in fact, there through leaked documents, there's some evidence now that suggests that there were some kind of explosion with all kinds of flames as the collapse was starting. I don't know from which floor, but that's very interesting information as well. So asymmetrical damage due to fires that were virtually gone out, as in the case of the South Tower, by the way, of the Twin Towers, and yet we have a symmetrical collapse. This doesn't happen in nature. A fire is an organic process. It can't take out core columns simultaneously on each given floor in order to facilitate a symmetrical collapse. This is something that every engineer will know intuitively, and that's why Building 7 is being called the smoking gun of 9/11, because it's so obviously a controlled demolition, and why they won't show it on the mainstream media.
And there are plenty of examples of both symmetrical collapses of high-rise buildings, and those are examples due to controlled demolition, and there are also examples, unfortunately, many examples of asymmetrical damage to high-rise buildings, say from an earthquake, which produces an asymmetrical collapse, right? Oftentimes the building will just tilt over and fall down, and it looks like a stack of cards or something like that, all laid out. It's not destroyed into its footprint. Now, also, Richard, you mentioned before about the evidence. And by the way, I'm sorry. I'd like you to say, good friends, when Richard speaks of NIST, that's an abbreviation for the National Institute of Science and Technology, Standards and Technology, or what is it again,
Richard? Yes, Standards and Technology.
Standards and Technology. Okay. So, Richard, when you say it was a crime scene and the evidence should not have been removed like that, in addition to that, it was also a massive failure, if what they say is true, of all of our laws of engineering and our building codes and so on and so forth. For that reason as well, the evidence should not have been removed, correct? It shouldn't have been taken apart with a fine-tooth comb so we can understand how after all these decades we've got it so wrong about how to construct our skyscrapers that they could so easily collapse from little office fires?
Yeah, well, there's two important points there. In a crime scene, in an arson investigation, well, in any fire investigation, they want to know exactly how it happened. They lay out the steel, they categorize it, they put it in back into computers. And this is Jonathan Barnett, who was with the FEMA investigation team, on our website, in our PPT, we have a video of him explaining exactly how they do this normally, and none of these procedures were followed. What we have is a complete scrubbing of the crime scene. And, oh, I forgot your second point. Name it again.
The second point, Richard, the second point is that this stands engineering and architecture on its head, right?
You guys
get educated to learn how to build buildings for us that are safe, and it won't just fall down at a sneeze or, you know, some minor office fires, right? And I guess
if the official story is true, that's all wrong, isn't it? This was pretty much a sneeze because what we have is a few small fires scattered and traveling throughout the building, mostly out by the time the collapse happened. You can see in all the collapse videos that the building is not engulfed in flames whatsoever. Now we must be concerned that our existing high-rises are all of a sudden vulnerable because they're all built basically the same way with 2 and 3 hour fire protection, and that's all they have. So if this fire can come down in an afternoon of scattered fires, then we have real problems because but not really, because we have over 100 examples of very hot, very large, and very long-lasting fires in high-rises, over 100 of these examples. And not one has come down due to these fires. And all of a sudden, this one comes down in 6.5 seconds. It's ludicrous.
It's ludicrous. And Richard, tell me, I mean, your stock in trade is observing engineering laws and building codes and fire ratings and so on and so forth. That stuff's been worked out over time, steel and stresses and engineering formulas and so on and so forth. Shouldn't there be a panic in the building industry as a result of these miraculous damages that occurred? Shouldn't there be a total reevaluation? Everything we knew was wrong. That hasn't happened, has it?
No, but the NIST report is coming out, and it's going to be very interesting to see the code officials throughout the country respond to this report, which is going to say that normal office fires brought this building down in 6.5 seconds after burning in the afternoon and going out, basically, in the afternoon. Fire travels through a building area in about every 20 minutes, moving on, seeking fresh new fuel sources. This leaves one area to cool while it's heating up another area, and that's why buildings, high-rise buildings have never come down. First of all, they're fire-protected, and remember, no plane hit Building 7. The column which they're looking at as the source of failure underneath the East Penthouse weighed 15,000 pounds per floor. It can't possibly heat up to its softening point in 20 minutes. It's impossible, and any fire protection engineer will tell you that.
Not only that, Richard, but steel wicks heat away, doesn't it? So you've got an entire superstructure there that this heat can be drawn throughout, and you know, it doesn't even get a chance to build up all that hot. Anyway, we're coming up to the end of our first hour here, and while we would love to have Richard on some more, he is busy about the good work of informing the American people and the world of what really happened that day. So, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to take calls with Richard tonight. But, Richard, we're going to want to have you back on the program at your convenience so that we can keep going and maybe take some calls. Is that okay with you sometime in the future?
Oh, you bet, Tom. Anytime.